Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we have our hands on a really, really complex, like systems thinking document.
Yeah, it's definitely not your typical light reading.
No, definitely not. But our mission for this deep dive is to unpack this framework. It uses concepts like ODECCT and something called paradox slang.
Right, which sounds like a sci-fi programming
It
language.
really does. But it applies those to the moral paradoxes of Israel. Specifically, we're exploring a pretty heavy central theme today.
Which is how moral choices directly impact a state's long-term survival and, its very identity.
Exactly. And before we jump in, we need to be crystal clear. The ideas, frameworks, and statements we're about to discuss belong entirely to the source document we've been provided.
Right, this is an analysis of a text.
We are not taking sides, nor are we endorsing any of these viewpoints. Our goal is strictly impartial. We are here to objectively report on the content and help you understand the fascinating analytical framework presented in the text.
Yeah, and what's really compelling here is that this document, it completely removes the emotional political rhetoric that we're so used to hearing. It just replaces it with system dynamics. It asks us to look at the survival of a nation through like the exact same mathematical lens we might use for fluid dynamics or, weather patterns.
It's just wild to think about morality as a differential equation. But okay, let's unpack this because the terminology is incredibly dense right out of the gate.
Yeah, it could be a lot.
So ODE, CCT, and paradox slang mapping out 64 distinct paradoxes. For those of us, meaning you and me, who don't have degrees in advanced systems engineering, what are we actually looking at?
So, it sounds intimidating, but the core concept is actually fairly intuitive. The ODE part stands for ordinary differential equations.
Okay,
That's
equation.
right. Like in physics or engineering, you use differential equations to track how things change over time when variables are, constantly affecting each
Like
other.
a weather system.
Exactly. Think about how a change in temperature affects air pressure, right? Which then creates wind. And then that wind drops the temperature even further. It's a continuous loop.
So the author is taking math that we use for weather or fluid dynamics and applying it directly to human behavior and statecraft.
Precisely. And the CCT portion, that refers to managing cognitive complexity. Basically, how do we wrap our human brains around these chaotic, multivariable systems without just, giving up?
Right, because geopolitical conflict is nothing if not a chaotic system.
Oh, absolutely. And then paradox slang is just the author's custom language or method, really, for mapping out these systemic paradoxes on paper. So we can literally see the feedback loops in action.
Got it. And, the most crucial feedback loop in the entire document, the one that really drives this whole theory, is what the author called the target paradox.
Yeah, this is the big one.
Right. So the core thesis here is, if a nation targets the children of other nations, it initiates this specific mathematical chain reaction.
Very dark chain reaction.
Very. It attracts morally compromised individuals to its population. And then that moral compromise dilutes the nation's cultural and genetic identity over time,
Right.
which weakens the people, makes them more vulnerable, and then that vulnerability leads to more violence. The text says the break in the cycle is moral behavior and the attractor is justice. But wait, I have to stop you there.
Yeah.
Because how can you possibly quantify a moral choice? I mean, math requires hard numbers, right? Rates of change. How does this framework actually turn something subjective, like justice or moral compromise, into a measurable variable in a math equation?
Well, it's a great question. And it's the hurdle most people face when they encounter systems thinking applied to like sociology.
Right, because it feels impossible to measure.
Exactly. But the framework doesn't quantify justice by putting points on a scoreboard. It quantifies it through systemic entropy and behavioral outputs.
Okay, unpack that a little.
Sure. Think of it like an audio feedback loop. You know when someone puts a microphone too close to a speaker?
Oh, yeah, you get that horrible piercing screech that eventually just blows out the audio equipment entirely.
Right. A tiny, almost imperceptible sound enters the microphone. The speaker amplifies it. Then the microphone picks up the amplified sound, feeds it back into the speaker, and it just compounds instantly until the system destroys itself.
So it's a loop that feeds on its own output.
Yes. And in this document's model, a state's moral compromise is that initial sound.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. If a state decides, we're desperate, so we will engage in behavior we know is abhorrent, like targeting the innocent just to survive today, the system registers that input.
The microphone picks up the compromise.
Exactly. The microphone picks it up and amplifies it. The people willing to carry out those orders and the people who cheer for them, they become the dominant force in the society.
Because the moderate, ethical voices are either drowned out or they just pack up and leave?
Yes, precisely. The state's internal identity degrades. The structural integrity of its institutions weakens because, well, they're now run by people comfortable with corruption and extreme violence.
Mm-hmm. Which, ironically, makes the state functionally weaker.
Exactly. Which invites more external threats, requiring even more desperate, immoral violence to survive. Mm-hmm. It's just a compounding loop of destruction.
So the system destroys itself.
Yes. The framework dictates that the only way to break that specific screeching cycle is moral behavior. The attractor, the mathematical state of equilibrium that actually stops the feedback loop, is justice.
Okay, let me try to put that in everyday terms for a second. Let's imagine a startup company, right?
Ooh.
And they are facing imminent bankruptcy.
Okay, I'll follow.
The leadership is desperate. So they decide to cut a massive ethical corner. They lie to a vendor, maybe they steal a client's data, just to make payroll and survive the month.
Right. Survival at any cost.
Exactly. And practically speaking, in the short term, it works. The cash clears. But the mechanism of the feedback loop has already started.
Because of the culture shift.
Right. The honest employees see this and they quietly start looking for new jobs. They quit. And now the company only attracts ruthless, unscrupulous employees who don't care about the rules.
Yeah. So eventually, those new employees destroy the core culture and the mission that made the company worth saving in the first place. The survival tactic mathematically guaranteed the destruction of the entity.
What's fascinating here is that that is a perfect translation of the mechanism. The text frames this not as like a divine punishment, but as a rigid system dynamic.
It's just how the machine works.
Yes. DNA and national identity aren't just static historical artifacts you put in a museum. They are actively, continuously shaped by the behavioral choices of the state.
Which naturally moves us into how the document categorizes these internal struggles.
Yeah.
Because if survival at any cost changes who you are, the state starts to fracture internally.
Right. We move into category X.
Yeah. The author outlines a whole web of what they call identity and purity paradoxes. And one that really jumped out to me is AO4, the mirror paradox.
The mirror paradox, yes. The premise is simple but kind of terrifying. It's just, we become what we fight. The state is constantly bouncing between mimicking the enemy's brutal tactics just to survive and then desperately trying to remain culturally and morally distinct from them.
And the framework uses the concept of oscillation to describe this.
Oscillation.
But it's not a passive swing, like a pendulum on a grandfather clock. It's an active, vinyl compounding. You fight a brutal enemy, so you adopt their brutality.
You have to win.
Right. Or so you think. Then the society looks in the mirror, recoils in horror at what it has become, and overcorrects toward purity, which might leave it tactically exposed.
But, you know, I want to push back on the author's premise here for a minute, especially regarding AO7, the survivor's paradox, which states survival at any cost ultimately costs survival.
It's a bold claim.
It really is. Because if I'm a policymaker, or let's go back to our startup CEO, and I am facing an existential threat, the literal end of my existence, don't I have to get my hands dirty?
You'd certainly feel the pressure too.
Is the document genuinely suggesting a state should choose moral purity, even if it means total annihilation?
That is the most vital question you could ask of this text. Truly. But the framework isn't prescribing a suicide pact. It isn't saying, you know, choose morality and cheerfully accept death.
Okay, so what is it saying?
Rather, it's exposing the hidden systemic cost of the dirty hands argument. We usually think of survival at any cost as a loan we can pay back later.
Right. We think we'll do this terrible thing today, survive, and then go back to being good people tomorrow.
Exactly. But the ODE-CCT framework proves that mathematically impossible.
Because the system has already recorded the new variable.
Right. You cannot unring the bell. The framework is pointing out that if you push the system entirely into survival at any cost, the identity of the state shatters.
The rot is already inside?
Yes. The corruption required to survive that way rots the state from the inside out, meaning the state you quote-unquote saved no longer exists anyway. Mm-hmm. It's about recognizing that every single survival tactic carries a systemic cost to your identity.
Oh, man. You can see how this leads to immense psychological whiplash for a population.
Oh, totally.
The text explores this through another one, the narrative paradox. Noting that history is written by the victors, but victims write poetry. The state's identity is violently oscillating between a victim complex and a victor complex.
And those two complexes offer very different advantages.
Right. The victim complex provides moral high ground and international sympathy, whereas the victor complex provides actual physical security and power. And right alongside that is the chosen people paradox.
Which is such a difficult tension. It's the tension between being chosen for privilege, meaning you believe the rules don't apply to you because of your special status,
right,
versus being chosen for responsibility, meaning you are held to an even stricter moral standard than everyone else.
And if a nation cannot stabilize that internal identity, it obviously cannot project a coherent strategy externally.
Exactly. It bleeds into everything.
Which brings us out of the internal psychology and into the physical world. How do these paradoxes manifest in warfare, policy, and governance? The source document maps this out in its conflict and governance categories.
Categories B and C.
Right. And this is where the differential equations stop being theoretical and start looking like the evening news.
This is where we see the audio feedback loops applied to literal military strategy.
So let's look closely at BU01, the protect by destroying paradox, which is the ingrained belief that we must protect our children by destroying their children. Or B10, the terrorist state paradox. We fight terrorists, terrorists fight us, we become terrorists.
Yeah, that oscillation again.
But here's where it gets really interesting. The one that I think demands the deepest look is B12, the siege paradox.
Oh, siege paradox is fascinating.
The text says, we besiege to weaken, besieging strengthens resolve. And I want to pause here for you listening because this feels incredibly counterintuitive at first glance.
It does.
Why does putting an enemy under a suffocating siege, cutting off their resources, isolating them, mathematically output a stronger, more resilient adversary?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the mechanisms, the how and why behind the paradox, it becomes agonizingly clear. When a state implements a siege, the explicit goal is to starve the enemy of resources so they give up.
Break their will.
Right. But human sociological systems don't work that way. Mm. When you isolate a population and induce extreme desperation, moderation is the very first thing to die.
Because there's no room for nuance when you're literally starving.
Exactly. The voices in that besieged population who might have argued for peace or compromise, they are suddenly discredited or, you know, killed.
Wow.
Secondly, extreme constraint breeds extreme innovation. If they can't import weapons, they learn to build them from scrap metal. If they can't cross a border, they build labyrinthian tunnel network.
Right, they adapt to the variable.
Yes. And finally, a siege creates unbreakable internal social cohesion. Nothing unifies a fractured group of people faster than a shared, inescapable external threat.
So the state expends massive resources, international goodwill, and its own moral capital to build a wall and enforce a siege, fully believing it brings safety.
But it doesn't.
The systemic output of that equation is a hardened, hyper-innovative, radically unified enemy with absolutely nothing to lose. You have literally engineered the exact monster you were trying to starve.
And traditional political science treats the siege, the radicalization, and the security threat as separate policy issues.
Like they're different files on a desk.
Exactly. But the brilliance of applying this framework to geopolitical conflict is that it proves they are not separate. They are the exact same variable looping back on itself. The state expects enemies, so it acts aggressively. That aggression fulfills the expectation by creating enemies.
We see that exact same structural problem in the political realm with CO1, the democratic paradox.
Oh, the tension there is immense.
The document points out the agonizing tension of trying to be both a fully Jewish state and a fully democratic state. If you lean too hard into the ethno-religious identity, you have to restrict democratic equality for minority populations.
Right.
But if you restrict democratic equality, you create internal division and international isolation, which makes the state less secure.
And on the flip side, if you lean entirely into pure, unrestricted democracy, demographic shifts could eventually vote the Jewish identity of the state out of existence.
Defeating the original purpose of the nation.
Exactly. It is a terrifyingly tightrope to walk. The moral choices, the decision to besiege a neighbor, the decision to restrict a right, they are constantly, continuously rewriting the DNA of the state's future survival.
Okay, we have just walked through a massive, frankly bleak web of contradictions. You have the mirror paradox, the siege paradox, the democratic paradox.
It's a lot.
It feels like we're looking at the blueprints of a machine that is meticulously designed to tear itself apart.
It really does.
So what does this all mean? If I'm listening to this, the obvious question is, how does the author suggest we navigate this maze? What is the way out?
Well, the author actually addresses this by zooming all the way out to what they call the unifying meta-paradox.
A meta-paradox.
Right. It serves as an umbrella over all 64 paradoxes we've discussed. It basically summarizes the condition like this. Israel is born from trauma, sustained by resilience, defined by a covenant, and tested by morality.
Okay.
The closer it gets to fulfilling its promise, the more it risks breaking it. The harder it fights to survive, the more it may destroy what it survives for.
Hold on, let's ground this. If I'm a policymaker sitting in a war room, I can't just throw my hands up and say, well, it's a meta paradox.
Right, you need actionable steps.
I have decisions to make today. How does a government actually use this framework to make a choice?
This is where the CCT, or cognitive complexity management, part of the framework comes in. Traditional problem solving is linear. It says, we have a security threat. Let's send tanks to eliminate the threat. Problem solved.
Action, reaction.
Exactly. But as we've seen, that linear action feeds back into the system and creates a much worse reality. The framework insists we have to stop trying to find fixed, static answers to dynamic contradictions.
You can't just put a Band-Aid on a differential equation.
You really can't. You have to shift from static morality, which are rigid rules that shatter under pressure, to dynamic ethics.
Dynamic ethics.
Right. You have to recognize that every single action feeds back into everything else. The goal isn't to violently force the system to stop moving. The goal is to find what systems theorists call a stable attractor or an equilibrium.
Let me try to translate that back to our startup analogy.
Please do.
So our startup is oscillating wildly between imminent bankruptcy and totally unethical, illegal behavior. A linear static fix is just stealing money from a client to make payroll.
Right. Solves the immediate problem.
It solves the immediate cash flow problem, but mathematically ensures the company's long-term destruction when the culture rots or, you know, the authorities find out. The CCT approach dynamic ethics would be recognizing the feedback loop. You recognize that cutting corners ruins the identity of the company. So you model the oscillation. You find a dynamic path.
Yes.
Maybe you pivot your core product, or maybe you openly and transparently renegotiate with your creditors based on your founding values. You don't eliminate the immense stress of being a struggling startup, but you find a path through the chaos that doesn't require sacrificing the identity of the company. You find a moral equilibrium.
That is an excellent translation. You don't solve the paradox of being a startup. You navigate it without losing your soul.
Wow.
The text states explicitly, the break in the cycle is moral behavior. The attractor is justice. The path is ethics. The author is arguing that justice isn't just a lofty, poetic ideal reserved for, like, philosophy classes.
Right. It's a structural requirement.
Yes. In the realm of system dynamics, justice is the mathematical equilibrium that prevents the system from shaking itself to pieces. It is the literal structural load-bearing pillar of a nation's survival.
It's treating ethics as the literal laws of physics. Like, if you ignore gravity, you fall. It doesn't matter if you believe in gravity or not.
Exactly.
And if you ignore dynamic ethics in your statecraft, if you choose survival at the cost of your moral baseline, your identity dilutes, your institutions weaken, and your state ultimately collapses under its own systemic weight.
It completely reframes how we view national defense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We usually think the most critical infrastructure a state possesses is its missile defense systems, or its intelligence agencies, or its GDP.
Right, the hard assets.
But this document suggests that the ultimate foundational infrastructure is its moral coherence. When that coherence degrades, the tanks and the walls eventually won't matter because the society wielding them has already disintegrated.
What a phenomenal way to view the world. Let's take a moment to wrap up the journey we've been on today. We started with a highly analytical document that used the mathematics of ODECCT and paradox Lang to map out the moral paradoxes of a nation.
A very heavy lift.
For sure. We explored the target paradox, seeing how immoral actions create an audio feedback loop that dilutes a nation's identity and invites its own destruction. We looked at internal struggles, like the mirror paradox, where a state risks becoming the very monster it is fighting.
And the physical consequences, like the siege paradox.
Exactly. Learning exactly why trying to starve an enemy mathematically outputs a stronger, more resilient adversary. And finally, we looked at the solution, stepping away from linear Band-Aid fixes and embracing dynamic ethics to find a moral equilibrium.
Navigating the chaos.
Right. The ultimate takeaway is that the source text presents moral choices as a literal, unavoidable survival equation for a state's identity and its future.
It is a staggering framework. And, you know, it brings to mind a final thought for you to consider as we close out this deep dive.
I'd love to hear it.
We spent our time today talking about how human morality and behavioral choices act as mathematical feedback loops that dictate the survival of nations. But consider how this applies to the digital ecosystems and artificial intelligence models we are currently building today.
Oh, wow, yeah.
AI learns by ingesting the data of our past actions. If we feed our AI systems the historical data of our own moral compromises, our brutal survival at any cost behaviors, and our unresolved paradoxes.
It learns from us.
Exactly. Will those digital systems inevitably inherit our flaws? Will they process that compromised human data and, following the exact same systemic feedback loops we just discussed, ultimately self-destructs or, you know, destroy us in the process?
That is an incredibly heavy, fascinating thought to leave on. Are we hard-coding our own moral entropy into the machines that will run our future? Crazy to think about. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive today.
Thanks for having me.
We hope this framework gave you a completely new lens through which to view the news, geopolitics, and even your own decisions. Keep questioning the information around you. Look for the hidden feedback loops in the systems you interact with, and we'll catch you next time.